If you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have John Bruce Leonard on the show. Of course, John is the editor-in-chief of Arctos. John studied philosophy, letters, and language in university curriculum based exclusively on the great books of Western tradition. After taking his degree in liberal arts, he moved permanently to Italy, where he nourishes his ever-living preoccupation with the heritage and the future of Europe. He joined Arctos in 2017. So, John, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Tim. Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Oh, thank you for coming on the show. Well, I have you on to talk about this series of articles that you wrote recently. The Liberal Mirage came in three parts. I think it was published in Arctos Journal.
That's correct.
Okay, which is the journal for Arctos. Now, what exactly is Arctos? What's its mission?
So Arctos is a small but growing publishing house. We concentrate primarily on literature which offers alternatives to the increasingly evident crises of our times. The general stance that Arctos takes is a stance of anti-globalism, an attempt to in some way correct or rectify some of the excesses, particularly that we've been seeing lately of our so-called liberal governments and things of this sort. So we offer a very wide range of authors who touch on a very wide range of subjects as well. Arctos itself does not take any ideological stance as such per se, but it rather sees itself as offering a forum for voices which might not be heard often enough or might not have an opportunity to speak in more mainstream publishing houses.
So in tackling or taking on the forces of liberalism, Arctos sees itself as generally liberal, meaning accepting diverse ideas. It's one of the...
Precisely. Yeah. Liberal in an older, let's say a classical sense, precisely right.
Yeah. This series of articles, The Liberal Mirage, I find it particularly interesting because you take on this idol of democracy, this goddess that we worship now here in the 21st Indeed. Century. And you kind of take on some of its internal contradictions, the problems of democracy, both philosophically and pragmatically, and you kind of call it a mirage. It isn't really what it is, and that's you call it out for the false claims, and really it kind of descends into totalitarianism, as we're seeing today in many cases with the deplatforming. Indeed. And apparently Jared Taylor wasn't allowed to go to Europe because he's a threat to public order there.
Exactly.
You know, all these, you know, this abuse of, you know, apparently they can control the borders when they want to, right?
You know? Yes, and against terrible threats like Mr. Jared Taylor.
Yeah, exactly. He's going to come in and check in a hotel and give a speech and leave, and you don't want that going.
Right,
you,
right.
If he were to come and, you know, and go on welfare and, you know.
Exactly right.
Come on. So, okay, so let's take on the liberal mirage. It's about, I saw about 17,000 words almost. So let's just start talking about what motivated you to write this and what is the liberal mirage?
Well, it's been an ongoing concern of mine to attempt to address some of the contradictions inherent in our present forms of government and, more broadly speaking, in the regime under which we live, which is to say the social and political order under which we live. It appears to me that the contradictions which are inherent in this regime are coming more and more to the fore, to the point that even individuals who once upon a time would have been quite content to adhere wholeheartedly and without any kind of doubt to the regime now begin to perceive its problems. And this is an interesting development because you have this situation in which many people who consider themselves to be of the left or who would call themselves liberals find themselves confronting manifestations of the present so-called liberal regime, which are anything but liberal in the original sense, which is to say pertaining to freedom, pertaining to liberty. Their attempt to understand or to come to terms with these difficulties leads them to a kind of impasse because they don't perceive the ways in which the systems that they themselves have established and supported and the regime that they themselves have built theoretically and practically is leading of a necessity to these ends. And so my attempt in many of the things that I write, and particularly in this essay that we're going to be speaking about here, is to attempt to show the way in which the theoretical underpinnings of the system, which have actually built it in a certain way, they've structured it in a certain way, cannot help but result in the place that we're presently finding ourselves. There's no way in which they might have led to a different outcome, unless, of course, they were favored by just a remarkable fortune, which no one could actually foresee or provide for. And this, I think, also is to some extent corroborated by the fact that this is not just an outcome or an illness that we are seeing in this or that particular liberal state. We are seeing this, practically speaking, across the board in all of the countries which have adopted the kind of Enlightenment-style liberalism which was developed, in the past several centuries. All of them are showing these same manifestations, these same very worrying, very concerning issuances into a kind of encroaching, really, I mean, totalitarianism, for lack of a better word, soft totalitarianism. This encroaching state which continues to impinge itself on us bureaucratically, but coupled along with a kind of informal augmentation of censorship on the part of big tech companies and all of these different aspects of a certain tendency that we see. So my goal is to simply show that this tendency is not something extraneous to or foreign to the liberal ideal, but is in fact contained within that liberal ideal.
Yeah, one thing that strikes me is supposedly, all these societies are democratic and liberal, and you would think if they are democratic and liberal, they'd be essentially populist. I mean, they reflect the popular will of the people,
right,
who vote in these governments. But there's a conformity you see throughout the West, and some people have called this global homo, because it's forcing a sort of degenerate program for ultimate deracination and also demoralization. This has been going on for decades in the West.
I mean,
even you can trace this all the way back to the French Revolution, as you can most modern movements, but we don't want to go back that far. But I'm saying the big push, particularly in the post-war era, post in the 21st century, how this is utter uniformity you were seeing. Like somehow Ireland is supposed to be the same as San Francisco or Paris or these things, and the destruction of local culture. And there seems to be a this isn't sort of a law, of physics working here. Like things fall apart. There's an intent, a plan. There's organizations. There's scheming, conspiracy, if you will, organizations that are well funded by corporations, NGOs, and these things that are perpetrating this. It isn't just happening. Not to mention the fact that you can cite various policies, like one thing like wars that are being civil wars are being fomented by NATO, the West, you know, what happened in Libya or what's going on in Syria, these things. So there appears to be real intent here.
Yes, I agree entirely with that. There is certainly intent here. And the intent very often is on the part of individuals who have absolutely no regard for democracy or for liberalism, even as it was classically understood, and who are simply taking advantage of the situation in which they find themselves, a situation in which through the absolute liberation of economic forces and capitalism, they have been able to essentially gain an enormity of wealth and resources, which they can use then to establish themselves in positions of kind of informal, unofficial power throughout the West. And we're definitely seeing that as well. I suppose that in many cases, the defenders of liberalism, the defenders of democracy, wish to suggest that all of these changes that we're seeing are somehow not the direct consequence of liberalism and democracy. They see these things as being kind of impositions on liberalism and democracy. It's my opinion that the more you actually investigate the way liberalism and democracy are actually built, the theoretical, the ideological underpinnings of these things, as well as just the kind of mechanisms which are involved, they will necessarily lead in this direction. And I mean, just as an example, you mentioned this kind of homogenization which happens. And I do not see how this could possibly be evaded once one has accepted this sort of idea of the human being as the sort of disembodied, unit which here, in Ireland or in California or in the Middle East or in Africa or anywhere you please, is really only interested in consuming, right? I mean, this is the basic standard of living that one has to establish all throughout the world. The basic thing that needs to be given to all human beings is the ability to, survive well with a kind of material well-being. And the result of this naturally is that you will deracinate human beings. I mean, you're focusing all of your attention on the economic aspect of human life because it's the one really measurable aspect of human life. And as a consequence, you have to try to eliminate the problems with that, the things that stand in the way of that, such as religious differences, such as ethnic or cultural differences. You have to ignore these things, and wherever possible, you have to undermine and eliminate them. We see this also with the growth of the secular state, for example. One has to attempt to make all human beings de facto atheistic, which is not to say that everyone claims they're atheists or they claim they don't believe in God. But essentially speaking, no one lives as if they did believe in God. Religion is reduced to a mere formality. And it has to be if you're going to establish a kind of democratic liberalism throughout the world, because otherwise you will come up inevitably against the fundamental problem that human beings deeply believe in irreconcilable worldviews. And if you don't find a way of eliminating those, then you cannot have your, exportation of democracy. You cannot have your free vote throughout the world. You cannot have your federation of democratic states, not to speak of a single world state. All of these things are deeply interrelated.
Yeah, mass politics and mass production go hand in hand, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
There's always some immediate benefits to these things. Like, we don't want to deny, obviously, the material benefits to the Industrial Revolution, life being nasty, brutish, and short for most people, and given the accoutrements or benefits of middle class lifestyle, there seems to be you'd like to think that you could strike a balance here. This is the same thing like issues like free trade. There's a sort of a Aristotelian meme or golden mean you can find with these things. But things tend to go too far, and that seems to be the problem here. We want our goodies, our gadgets, and our conveniences, but this goes back to your discussion with Joaquin Flores. It all goes back to the washing machine.
Yeah, right, exactly.
The convenience of the washing machine. But what are the effects of the convenience of the washing machine or the vacuum cleaner? Idle time being the devil's workshop, it spawned all types of horrible ideologies or things, at least ideologies that can be utilized by the oligarchs to deracinate and denature society, these things. Like, things like feminism, which isn't anything at all about improving the lot or lives of women. It's about, the moral corruption, destruction of civilization. You talk about democracy, in the article, in the first article, you talk about, you know, basically, let's be honest with ourselves. Democracy is a myth. Liberalism is a myth. The system doesn't work as advertised. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Certainly. So, I mean, the idea of democracy is something as follows. One establishes a society or a system of government in which all of the individuals who participate in that government are able to influence it through the vote. There's consequently this kind of inbuilt mechanism by which when things go too far in a certain excessive direction, the people can redirect it towards something which is more favorable to, generally speaking, and most of the time, an outcome which is favorable to the whole of society rather than simply to a part of society. So this is kind of the idea. This is the theory behind democracy, put very, very briefly and in kind of poor terms. But when one looks actually at the way the democracy plays out, this is not what we perceive. We perceive rather that democracy tends to hierarchize into these different strata of social orders. And these social orders are very, very different from the class system, which once held sway in practically the entirety of the Western world, in which there was, say, an aristocracy. There was a ruling class, which was generally hereditary. And then there was the burgher or the mercantile class. And then there was the kind of the common people. The present order, rather, is one in which the rulers are hidden, or they pretend that they're not rulers. They pretend that they're not aristocrats, and certainly by the original sense of that term, they're not aristocrats. I mean, we call them the elite, and that's simply to indicate that these are people who are freed from the concerns of most human beings in an economic sense. They are very, very wealthy, so they are not constrained to pay heed to the need of to get their living or to feed their families, etc., etc. They live to a different order of concerns, and in order to understand the real state of democracy, you have to understand exactly how this class is constituted. Who are these people, and how did they arrive? And so now here we return to the kind of idealistic democratic theory. By idealistic democratic theory, you have a number of individuals who present themselves in order to become the rulers through valid electoral vote, so through elections. These people are certainly ambitious. I mean, I think that all of the theoreticians of democracy or of early republics have always acknowledged that these individuals would be ambitious. But the idea was that these individuals would also have some care for the commonweal or for the society as a whole. They would have some kind of civic concern. And there was the hope that anyone who presented himself for public office would have this kind of civic concern. But in point of fact, that doesn't seem to be the case. And so we have to give an explanation for why this has failed. And I think it's actually fairly easy to give an explanation for why it's failed. If you consider the reasons that an individual would have to attempt to gain a position of power in a democratic society, these are not individuals who have been bred into a kind of ruling caste. So these are not people who have been raised with politics in their families. These are not people who have been instilled with a certain kind of moral or ethical sense of responsibility with respect to their societies. These are individuals who are born practically anywhere. And the one thing that drives them to attempt to get voted into office is essentially a desire for, and I mean, here the question is for what? And I think that we can say it's for a very, very small number of things. It's either for power or it's for money. Those two things, of course, are very closely related. Or else it's really from some kind of genuine desire to aid the society, to do better by the society, et cetera, et cetera. But it's clear that most people who want to actually help society are not going to get embroiled in politics. Politics is too dirty. It's too it requires too many compromises. It's not something that most idealistic individuals would seek. Most of the people who get involved in politics are simply interested in establishing some kind of power. I mean, they're interested in power. They're interested in becoming influential individuals in their societies.
Yeah, some people have called it a Hollywood for ugly people.
Yeah, it's exactly right. And you know, it's interesting to see that there have been increasing connections between Hollywood and politics, particularly in the past 50 years. Oh, yeah. But I mean, that's understandable because many of the same traits that push a man to want to become an actor, say, and to spend his entire life, you know, with his face posted on this or that magazine or, you know, in movies where he's pretending to be something that he's actually not and everyone worships him. Many of those same characteristics and motives actuate our politicians as well. So there's a deep similarity there.
Yeah, they're all actors. That's definitely the
case. Yeah, right, exactly. And I mean, you know, the point here is that they're all actors, but they're all actors because the very political order that we've established encourages actors to come forth. And what's more, I mean, particularly with the advent of modern technology, their ability as actors is determinant of their ability to arrive in positions of power. They have to be able to put on a good show. They have to be able to put on, you know, the right face and the right tone. They have to be able to manipulate the sentiments of the people and the emotions of the people in just the right way. They have to be able to say the right thing at the right time. And I mean, it's clear that any kind of political position will demand a certain degree of deception in a democracy, and the people who are able to lie best are the ones who finally arrive at the highest echelons of power, because these are people who have been carefully filtered through our media, through our video, our television, through the internet. They've been carefully filtered to be the most successful liars and actors of the entire run of potential politicians. So, I mean, in that way, it's a very perverse order that we've established.
Yeah, it's almost like there is a sort of a general awareness of this. Anyone who gives politics at least a bit thought or follows, you know, the personalities involved in various controversies are aware that they're being lied to constantly, yet they still support their man. You know, good example of people that supported Bill Clinton, you know, back in the 90s, despite the fact all that was, you know, that was exposed and, you know, much that wasn't that really that people know about, you know, the career of the Clinton. Same with Hillary Clinton. There's no way an intelligent person could be aware of Hillary Clinton's career and the various scandals. Yet still, they plastered the sticker on their in the bumper sticker on their car and put the sign out in their yard because they were Democrats or they saw something to gain from the system. These things, and you know, same thing with right wing politicians. I'm not just picking on Democrats here. But with democracy,
the Democrats have put forth a number of very
yes.
surprising candidates along those lines.
Yeah, they're just you know, they're the evil party. Republicans are the stupid party, as they say. You know? but you talk about sort of there's a certain with democracy, there's an inevitability of oligarchy. I mean, and you can make the Hollywood, you know, just like how we have Hollywood personalities, we have, you know, the stars that instructed to worship, but behind them are the oligarchs that control Hollywood, right? And the same thing with politics. There's a certain inevitability with oligarchy, and we talk about democracy. We all go out and vote. We're told to vote. We wear little stickers that say, "Hey, I voted," you know. And apparently, that's supposedly the most important thing our civic duty is to vote.
Civic duty, exactly.
But nevertheless, people are generally aware of things like. Past few years, like terms like the deep state, the cryptocracy, idea,
the establishment,
the notion of a dollar democracy. I mean, let's face it, democracy is the belief that my vote matters as much as, say, someone like a David Rockefeller. Well, it does matter more now; he's dead. But I'm saying is there was a time there was a saying that's saying if you believe in democracy, you think your vote matters as much as David Rockefeller's. We know that simply isn't true. There's gray eminence, power, you know, behind the throne, money. And they call it a dollar democracy. And not to mention the reality of psychological warfare, because to the extent that politics follows the popular will isn't pure. It can be manipulated, and it has been manipulated. I mean, we have quotes, you know, Walter Lippmann's wrote books about this, about manipulating public opinion. I think his book was called Public Opinion. All that was about manipulating the masses, not informing them so they make the best decision, edifying them so they can be good citizens, manipulating them so they can be managed by the elite. Of course, there's Edward Bernays, you know, his famous quote, the conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate This unseen mechanism of society constitutes an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. We are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes are formed, our ideas are suggested, largely by men we've never heard of. This is the logical result of the way in which our democratic society is organized. So it goes back to democracy again. And not to mention the impact of like think tanks or foundations that determine what's taught in universities, studies that are made, they're published. And there's an interlocking dynamic here, meaning almost Masonic organization where all these organizations are interlocked. They control what's in the media. Then the media controls what's manipulates public opinion. The politicians respond to public opinion. But if you really look into it, it's all centrally organized.
Yes, and this again represents an astounding failure with respect to the original democratic theory. So again, returning to the original democratic theory, the idea was that the education of the citizenry was absolutely essential. This has always been regarded as a fundamental part of any kind of democratic order, and even republican order, taking republic in the older sense of the term. You had to be able to establish a kind of basic standard of informativeness or knowledge amongst the citizenry so that the citizenry could do its job and, you know, vote in appropriate leaders who were able to tackle the problems of the day in an appropriate manner. Now, I mean, we're essentially seeing many individuals, including many individuals who, in my opinion, sincerely actually do support and believe in democratic government. They've kind of thrown that idea over completely, and they're much more interested now in forming public opinion, shaping public opinion. That's kind of the nice way of saying manipulating public opinion. And the reason for this, again, is practically evident. The idea that a citizenry could be educated to the extent that it's capable of understanding the basic issues confronting a nation which is of the size and complexity of practically any modern nation, certainly places like the United States, but practically any modern country, even some of the smaller European states have this problem. This idea is fundamentally absurd. In the first place, most people in any society you please simply do not have the time to inform themselves about issues. It's not as if they can, you know, pass hours and hours of their day really researching these things or looking into these things, for the very simple reason that they have families and jobs and they have other things to care for. This not even to speak of just kind of the natural differences in intelligence or ability between human beings. To expect the citizenry, the people as such, to be able to confront these questions with any kind of, you know, real preparation is to hope for something which is fundamentally impossible. Now, it was originally hoped that this could be supplemented through things like the free press. The free press being an independent estate, right? So, I mean, it was considered to be something separate from the classes or the ruling powers of society.
Yeah, the fourth estate, isn't it?
The fourth estate, exactly. Exactly right, yeah. And this, again, is separating it from the aristocracy, from the priest caste, from all of these other aspects of society. So it was to be independent from all of these things. And it was to look at these things with some kind of, if not objectivity, at least a degree of neutrality that, you know, most private individuals cannot permit themselves. Its job was to provide the information and the knowledge that private individuals were unable to give to provide for themselves. And then the private individuals, in consuming this kind of neutral, impartial analysis of the present situation, would be informed to an extent that they would be in a position that they could actually, you know, vote responsibly. They could assess the different platforms or proposals of candidates and parties, et cetera, et cetera. And this essentially is not come to pass in the least, for the very simple reason that the press has proved itself to be not impartial or neutral. As you so rightly point out, the press has become a kind of organ of these hidden economic forces, and in many cases of specific and nominable individuals who actively seek to manipulate what we call the narrative, right? When we now have this word for it, the narrative, which indicates that these people are not giving, you know, an objective or impartial analysis of the situation. They are telling a story. They're telling a story with a moral. They're telling a story with a plot, which is, you know, very specifically structured toward a very specific end. And they're doing so in order to shape or mold or manipulate public opinion. And so, I mean, again, here there's this kind of way in which democratic theory, which looks very nice on paper, over the long run tends to collapse at these identifiable points, these weak points within the theory itself, and certainly within the practice.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these things. If you look at to the extent that people are willing and able to inform themselves, we've seen this, you know, sort of with the internet, where you have access to information, so you can, if you want to, you can capitalize on your leisure time and learn a lot. But then again, the establishment doesn't like that. That's why you have this attempt in the recent years to shut down the most interesting aspects of the internet. I mean, you can you can stream porn all day. They're happy with that. But you know, you start questioning the fundamental principles or ordering of society or the policies of the governments and what's going on, well, then that's not to be accepted. Getting back to the idea of politicians, I ran an interesting story way back when I think Teddy Roosevelt was either met with or was writing to Franz Joseph I of Austria, the emperor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And he explained to Teddy Roosevelt, the democratic politician, what his job was. And he says, my job is to protect the people from their government, from the politicians. And in some of their writing, I get a sympathetic in your article. At least with aristocracy or monarchy, there's an honesty that the power is separated from money. And whereas, so that there's something to be said for monarchical systems. And I think even writers such as Hans Hermann Hoppe, the libertarian, has written about that. Even by liberal standards, the monarchies, I mean the classical liberal standards or libertarian standards, these monarchies were far more preferable in terms of size of government, moderation, than the liberal democratic states.
And their leaders were also, I mean, again, one has to understand the context of the ruling class itself. In traditional aristocracies, which in many historical moments were clearly corrupt and they'd grown terribly effete, and all of the problems that we tend to view so clearly in aristocracies certainly did from time to time exist. But nonetheless, we're speaking of hereditary classes which are dedicated to rule. And this includes necessarily a certain ideal of responsibility, of noblesse oblige. This includes necessarily a way in which, you know, you are the aristocrat is raising his sons in particular to become the new rulers. And obviously, there's a way in which the aristocratic classes are disconnected from the working classes, much more fundamentally, I think, than, you know, the present elite is disconnected from the present day working classes, insofar as nowadays, at least, there are, you know, through our technology and our media, there are ways of accessing these different realities, even though it depends on sympathy, etc. But nonetheless, the aristocrat had this inbuilt sense of duty, and this kind of duty was propagated throughout the entirety of the class from generation to generation. In the present case, we have no such ideal of duty whatsoever. I mean, one might pay lip service to a certain idea of civic duty, as we've talked about, but practically speaking, that doesn't mean anything. The founders of our present governments understood this, and they attempted to replace these older ideas of duty and these older kinds of moral inhibitions and moral, say, feedback mechanisms, to use this terrible scientific term. They tried to replace these with checks and balances, with, you know, the balance of powers, with these institutional mechanisms. And here, using the word mechanism in its literal sense, mechanisms which would mechanically see to it that no power could take precedence over all of the others. And the problem with this, of course, is that it only works to the extent that each of the individual powers is existing simply and exclusively within that system. If that's the case, then yes, to an extent you can control different interest groups or different factions through the balance of powers. But the moment that you have, as we do have globally in our present super complex, super sophisticated economic systems, the moment you have powers which extend past that sphere of the state, past the limits of government, past certainly any kind of written constitution, it's clear that they will be able, through the formation of different alliances and through the augmentation of their powers, to manipulate and to essentially use those mechanisms against themselves. I mean, we see this, for example, in laws which are now produced in any number of modern states, which are attempt to solve some of the problems that these democratic states are confronting. For example, laws on campaign reform or on attempting to limit the financing that is given to individuals or the money that they can use when they run for office. And when you look into these laws, very often you find that they were actually promulgated by individuals who are known manipulators of these systems. I mean, George Soros, for example, has had his hand on these things in many cases. So these systems are systems. They're mechanisms. And if you have somebody with sufficient means, sufficient power, and sufficient ability who is standing outside of the system, it's clear that he can adjust them. He can change their operation. Again, returning to George Soros, he said once that he is interested in changing the rules of the game, and he's not the only one. There are many individuals who are interested in changing the rules of the game. They exist outside of the game at this point, and so they're able to change these rules. All of these mechanical and systematic attempts to regulate the lives of human beings and the ambitions of human beings are inadequate, and they show themselves to be just extraordinarily poor and insufficient when compared to the older attempt to change people's morality, to change the way that they actually approach one another on a moral plane.
Well, it's all very rational, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's very scientistic. Yeah. I mean, and it's just part and parcel of the times in which we live.
And doesn't take into account the vagaries of human nature in these things, and where a more traditional order did. And
at least in a way, it even wants to substitute them, though, doesn't it? I mean, wants to just kind of ignore their existence and find ways of working around the existence of those human vagaries.
Yeah, just the idea that you can just issue forth rights without any corresponding obligations or duties, and obviously the demonic policy, we'll talk about rights, what you have coming to you, right? I'm going to give this to you. And of course, no one ever talks about how it's going to, Bernie Sanders saying everyone should get a free education, as if, college professors fall from heaven like manna or something. Well, no, these things cost money. Whether or not, and of course, no one goes to questions whether or not it's a good idea to go to college. I don't know if that's really a good idea anymore. Forever was. At least, mass college education might be a contradiction in term if you want it to be higher education, but that's mass democracy. But then the whole point is that no one talks about obligations and duties. We talk about, a right to an abortion, right? There's a right to an abortion. But no one talks about the duties or obligations one has not only to their children, the next generation, but the fact that you have a duty just based on the reality that there's an unborn child that needs to be allowed to live, and you have an obligation to these things, or the fact that you would have that this obligation creates the right to parenthood and vice versa, and also this creates the obligation of the father to the child. And this is just, I'm just drawing out the abortion issue, how that's a good example how certain contradictions of laws are now readily apparent, because while in the West, a woman can attain an abortion unilaterally, unlimited for the most part, she can still lay claim to the husband's income for support. You would think that obligation to support the child would create a right on part of the father. But there's a contradiction there, and it's a good example of this rights talk. It breaches that. Not to get into the abortion issue, I'm just saying that's a good example of all this rights talk.
Certainly.
And there's no sense of moral obligation or duty. And this goes again to the secularization of the West. In traditional governments, when you had, even in a confessional state where there's sort of just a general acceptance of a certain moral order, and if you have to maintain the moral order for any political and ultimately material progress. And since the Enlightenment, and particularly in the 20th century, you've seen this sort of disregard for the moral order for this rationalistic rights approach where, you know, everyone has a certain claim to consume, to have things, but there's no obligations on the part of the individual to the collective, nor there's any regard to the collective. The irony is by destroying a collective community, you know, deracinating people, you atomize individuals and they have no rights at all, because we're only in identifying with the collective can we vindicate our rights.
Yes, it's absolutely true. And one sees this from the very, very beginnings of modern thought, of early Enlightenment thought, this kind of focus on rights rather than duties. And I mean, this is not the place to get into exactly why that shift occurred, but it has governed so much of the development of our modern forms of social life and also political life that it really has to be recognized. I mean, what you brought up, the example that you brought up, I think is an extremely relevant one insofar as it really clarifies the extent to which these changes have been made. The question of abortion is, I mean, it doesn't even matter what one believes about the question of abortion. Simply the fact that we are today inclined to favor the choice of an individual to, you know, attempt to pursue this kind of nebulous happiness rather than to found and establish a family, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is just kind of just stated in general terms. This is the inclination of this. And when you look at the consequences of that same inclination, not only in this particular question, but across the board, you begin to see that a society which is founded on this idea of, you know, the right to life, liberty, and property, or the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness will eventually tear itself apart. And there's no way around this, because what you have is a state, a society, a civilization in which every individual believes that he has this, God-given right to, practically speaking, whatever he wants. Because, I mean, particularly with this little concept of the pursuit of happiness, which I think has been so effective, particularly in the development of the American culture, American society, the American way of life. What is this pursuit of happiness? I mean, you have the right to what exactly? What does that mean? I mean, it essentially means you have the right to do whatever makes you happy, and no one else can decide what makes you happy. So that in and of itself obliterates the idea of duty. There can be no duty in a scheme in which you are the only one who can decide what's right, what's good for you, what will make you happy, and furthermore, you have the right to actually pursue those things. I mean, obviously there are these limits which are supposed to be put around this, which are completely inadequate, limits which stop you from doing anything that, you know, offends against the rights of other individuals. But we've all seen that, you know, that works up until a certain point, but the moment you arrive at a specific point in the development of this kind of rights-oriented thinking, there is a necessary clash between what makes you happy and what makes another person happy. One sees this, for example, in the whole debate around safe spaces, these so-called safe spaces. I mean, if one person's right to the pursuit of happiness includes not being exposed to certain ideas or to certain images or to what have you, and another person's pursuit of happiness includes expressing those ideas, you've got to make a choice between the one and the other. And at that point, there's no simple legalistic way of determining, you know, which of those should be given the prerogative.
Yeah, yeah. The idea that, again, yeah, you have a right to be free of uncomfortable ideas.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
And in a public forum, like a university of all places, you know, you can't go into the forum and say, you know, I'm afraid of other ideas, or, you know, was it agoraphobic, I think? What's the term for that? Fear of crowds?
Agoraphobia.
Agoraphobic. Yeah. I mean, you go into the public. Well, no, then if you're afraid of ideas, then stay at home and don't turn on the computer or don't, you know, it's kind of like you insulate yourself, but you can't expect this. But again, that is directed at ideas of a certain political bent, meaning it isn't universal, meaning that a right-wing person were to make that claim, he wouldn't get the support of the university.
No, certainly. No, yeah. There's obviously a great deal of politics here as well.
Yeah. It's an example of repressive tolerance, as Marcuse said, right?
Exactly.
And you get, you know, some ideas are, you know, all ideas are equal, but some ideas are more equal than others, as they say. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea, again, is what are your obligations to your family, to your community? And these things, by their very nature, restrict liberty. Because you can't do what you may want to do in any given particular moment. Society and also individuals need a certain degree of prescription and proscription, and that presumes authority, which is theoretically contradicts the liberal order. But again, we go back to the liberal order being, as we see now, as sort of unveils its fangs, they're the most authoritarian, totalitarian, or people around are these, you know, so-called liberal activists with political correctness in these things. They have no regard for free speech. Was useful when it can tear down institutions, but if you employ free speech to preserve or to wage a counter-revolution, then they're against free speech.
Yes, and this gets to the heart of another very interesting contradiction in my mind within the contemporary liberal theory. Which again has its consequences within the contemporary liberal practice. And that's the idea of liberty. I mean, you said that the idea of duty forms a kind of restriction on the idea of liberty. And by our modern concepts, that is absolutely the case. And obviously, you know, with the tendencies that our contemporary societies have, it's clear which of the two concepts is going to be given more favor. I mean, if you have to choose between, you know, heaping so-called responsibilities on your shoulders as opposed to, you know, just living how you damn well please and going about doing whatever you wish. Obviously, most people, unfortunately, in our societies are going to choose the latter because there's been no proper education in duties and in responsibilities. But, you know, having said that, this idea of freedom that we have, which is simply a freedom from external restraints, this kind of freedom, which is a freedom to do whatever one wants, regardless of the moral consequences, regardless of the consequences for oneself or for others. This idea of freedom is not a classical idea. You cannot find an idea of freedom like this in older traditions, in pre-modern traditions. This idea of freedom arises precisely within modernity, within the earliest theoreticians of modernity, men like Hobbes and Locke, who attempted to alter the idea of freedom so that it could be accommodating to the idea of equality under the law and to these new liberal orders that they were proposing. And essentially what they did was they uncoupled the idea of liberty from the idea of morality, the idea of duty. Whereas in past times, it was understood that in order to fulfill one's liberty, one had to fulfill one's duties. The two things went hand in hand. I mean, in the Roman tradition, for example, virtus, virtue, and libertas, liberty, these two things were coupled together. They couldn't be disconnected. In our own day, freedom is anarchical. You know, you can be a completely worthless human being. You can be a scoundrel, and you can still be free. That was absolutely not the case in older times. In older times, you know, a scoundrel was essentially unfree, was essentially a slave, precisely because he was a slave of his passions. He was a slave of his
St. Augustine, yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You find this throughout the Christian tradition. You find this in the Greek tradition. This idea of freedom as being disconnected from morality is essentially modern. And it's been an enormously effective kind of conceptual change that we're all living under today, but it's one that really has to be brought into the light because its consequences have been dramatic and, in my opinion, in many cases, also extremely detrimental to social order and to also our ideas of government.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was John Adams said, you know, our Constitution presupposes a religious and moral people.
Yes.
No constitution can function without it. So you need that sort of undergirding or meta understanding of things, whereas the political process, the mechanisms of the political process need a virtuous public to believe in objective right and wrong, have a morality that restrains them, unrestrains passions, unrestrained passion. You become a slave to your vices. Man has many masters as he has vices, as Augustine said. And but the thing is, the oligarchs that we have spoken of know how to manipulate our passions through the mechanisms that we've spoken of, Bernays and these, the manipulation of public opinion and satisfying our, appealing to our base desires through mass entertainment and these things. This is something, I mean, you can't separate this from technology. Obviously, mass communication, nope. Yep. Which was developed for the whole point of manipulating. There's a book called Christopher Sipson called the Science of Coercion. And it studies the development of mass communication in the 1930s and through the 1960s. It was primarily a military thing. And it starts with, the Radio Research Project and Orson Welles' broadcast of War of the Worlds, which was a test. It wasn't an accident. The idea of manipulating public opinion or public perception through mass media, because this was, raised in art form with television, these things. Now, the whole idea of mass communication, mass entertainment, was to manipulate the masses, to control the masses through entertainment, breads and circuses, if you will. But yeah. Something like something as destructive as pornography, where just as recently as 20 years ago was restrained just because of distribution. But now with the internet, I mean, let's face it, when I was a kid, the only access you had to it was magazines you found in an alley in the woods somewhere. Right. Someone's father got it, right? You know, right, you know. Right. But it was always, I mean, obviously when they started producing it and they gave it the protection of First Amendment in these things, which it was never intended to protect, that was for political speech. They knew that even if you published it and controlled its sale, it would inevitably proliferate throughout the community. You know, they knew that, and they did it, yep. Which is an argument against it, by the way, because you always ask a pornographer, okay, you're only selling to adults, but how do you control its distribution? But then with the internet, you know, with the Communications Decency Act, ironically called, they allowed for it streaming everywhere. Now it's everywhere. You have a smartphone, you got it at your fingertips, and kids have smartphones. And this is an example of sort of this Faustian deal we've made with technology, I'm just pointing out pornography because that's the best example of appealing to base desires and sort of beguiling and demoralizing the public through the psychological warfare we call pornography and this is also goes back to the sexual revolution, which goes back to our issue of rights and duties, the idea that you can be sexually liberated as if you can be liberated from the consequences of one's actions. It's ridiculous. The only way you do it is you either pay for it in some other form or someone else pays for it, you know, like a dead baby or something or a broken family. You know, there's no way to break free. And if you look at the lives of libertines, their lives are always wrecks. They never have happy lives, you know.
So. Right. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, even this idea of bread and circuses shows just to what extent we've fallen, because even the idea of bread and circuses, which was already a very vulgar and low idea in its time, is so much more honorable than, you know, the alternatives that we're facing today, which yeah. is what, McDonald's and pornography and video games or something like this. But anyway, yeah, absolutely. There is, again, inbuilt into this kind of liberal order, a tendency to encourage the rulers, the ruling classes, the influential classes, to find a way of manipulating as well as they are able the system in which they find themselves. And I'm deliberately using these words like system and mechanism, and you know, all of these mechanical metaphors for our organic orders, because we have attempted to replace an organic order with a machine, and this is the consequence of that attempt. So you have these individuals who are placed in positions of power within these systems, within these mechanisms, within these machines, and it's obvious that they will attempt to find ways of, you know, just like any slick operator, of manipulating the machine in this way or manipulating it in that way so that it runs more according to their specific aims and their specific desires. And the best way that this can be done is by essentially, on the one hand, attempting to eliminate all of the most prominent, let's say, desires of the people, the things that might make the people rebel against an order if they don't get what they want. So you're encouraging them to do things like, you know, watch pornography in order to eliminate or alleviate, that's the idea at least, you know, their their sexual frustrations or whatever it is they call them, or, you know, encouraging them to spend all of their time in entertainments. So, you know, watching movies or television shows or playing video games, all of these things which take away their leisure time, which they might be using to look into things a little bit more clearly to try to understand their situation. And at the same time, you know, it kind of channels their frustrations, and it makes them less able to articulate these things. And on the other hand, there's this real motivation to attempt to dumb the people down, to make them stupider and less able to actually legitimately critique what you're doing. And so there's a an inbuilt motivation within these orders to attempt to lower the level of education, to attempt to make the people ever more susceptible to, you know, subliminal messaging or to the kinds of extremely simplistic messages which one sees in advertisement and in the media. A docile and malleable people at the hands of an elite like this makes the elite essentially super powerful. They can do whatever they want. And so it's clear that they don't want the people to be, you know, educated. They don't want the people to be aware of what's happening. They don't want the people to be in a position to, you know, actually in a position to be able to inform themselves about the real state of affairs. They want the people to be kind of self-satisfied and complacent and quiet and tranquil. I think that even drug use to an extent has a role here. I believe that, you know, in many cases, for example, legalizing marijuana might be seen as a means, again, for tranquilizing the people, or, encouraging the use of all kinds of, you know, even non-chemical soporifics, like, again, television shows, et cetera, et cetera. So all of these ways in which we have actively replaced vital and living desire to improve society with a desire to see the better part of society lowered in terms of its quality, lowered in terms of its knowledge, its information, its intelligence, for the benefit of a very small number of individuals who are thereby able to get what they want with, you know, greater ease and facility.
Yes, the drug thing is interesting because of that dialectic there, because the drug war itself can be used to abridge and violate the Constitution. It's a pretext for things like, you know, Fourth Amendment rights, and these things can be limited in the name of waging the drug war, because you simply can't enforce the drug laws and follow the Constitution.
You know, certainly.
Here in the United States, the federal drug law is completely unconstitutional because there's no, you know, when they passed a law against... When they passed prohibition, they actually had to amend the Constitution. They never bothered to amend the Constitution for drug prohibition. But nevertheless,
well, because we don't care about the Constitution anymore, yeah. Tim. Right? We can do without worrying about the Constitution. Now it's all in the hands of, you know,
technocrats,
our legislators. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And but there's at the same time, the same powers that, you know, that imposed the drug laws in order to fight drugs were behind its widespread distribution. It goes back to, you know, the American elite were founded upon the opium trade, the skull and bones, right, and these things. But, you know, we can cite, it's been well documented and exposed, the efforts of the Central Intelligence Agency, collusion with various gangsters and now banking and high finance in the, the trillion-dollar global drug trade. But, you know, the whole opium war strategy where you sort of opiate the masses to weaken it so you can conquer them. And we've seen that from time to time here in the States. I suspect that what's going on now with the opioid crisis and also methamphetamine, and there was a crack cocaine in the 80s and these things, where there's at the very least sort of a disregard for its widespread effects on society just so you can maximize profits. At the same time, it's a way, again, to sort of wage sort of economic warfare and plunder the society, because if you're familiar with the studies of like Catherine Austin Fitz about the function of the global club trade and how the warps the economy, it creates sort of this corporatization and centralization of society, undermining local economies and these things, which has an effect on the area, you know, where local businesses are supplanted by Walmart and Target and these things. And so people lose local, you know, loyalties and there's economic opportunities lost, and this actually feeds into the use of drugs because of demoralization and these things.
Right, right.
So, I mean, it's very complicated, but you can you can also gentrify a community. You can destroy a community, then gentrify it and make money off it. So it's a form of sort of speculation where you can actually, you know, we see this internationally, globally, like Libya. Libya was raided by NATO. You can destabilize a country, and once you destabilize a country, you can have at its resources at a low cost, even exploit the labor. And this goes back to the sort of this the liberal idea or the Whig idea of economic homo economicus. It's the economics that all that matters, and not morality. And how long ago, I guess there was 17th century economics, you know, was which used to be a substratum of morality. They sort of flipped it, and morality became a substratum of economics. And now, if you can just cite supply demand in the market, you can do whatever you want: exploit labor, bring in right. cheap labor from a sort of a destabilized or weakened country to flood the labor market, or bring out a cultural program. What's kind of what we're seeing in Europe now is this effort to destroy national identity, the ethnostate, and these things. I think it was Wesley Clark, when he was head of NATO, proclaimed the era of the European ethnostate was over. I guess he was the Commissar of Nations. I guess he can have that authority, but we see that policy being carried out now with, sort of this bio warfare, mass migration, to destabilize the Europe, what remains of the ethnostates in Europe, and a lot of this is because they want to bring out that homo. You can say global homo. Is that homosexuality? Is it promoting global homosexuality, or is it global homogeny?
Homogeny, exactly.
Yeah, so it's a great term because you can.
It is.
It covers both because the one serves the other.
That's very good though. Yeah, exactly, exactly.
I mean, so now what we're seeing now with supposedly the liberal democracy and gets where we started is this sort of this demographic warfare, which is written about. I think Kelly Greenhill wrote a book called Weapons of Mass Migration, where the use of migration to destabilize a country is an old form of statecraft. It's nothing new.
That's interesting. Yeah. And I think it can be broadly said that the elite of our present time, I mean, for lack of a better word, this is the word that's come into use. And so we'll accept it, even though, the original sense of elite was actually much more like aristocracy. Mm-hmm. But the elite of our time are extremely opportunistic. They are flexible and they are resilient. And unfortunately, I think these are qualities that very often their enemies do not possess to the same extent. But they're capable of taking advantage of situations and of changing their approach to situations. They're not constrained by any kind of simplistic ideological necessity. It's not as if they have to approach all of these things in a certain way. So again, returning to the example of the drug trade, they can play both sides of that, and they have no trouble doing so because their ultimate aim is something far beyond that, right? I mean, they're extremely Machiavellian in this sense. the same thing can be said for most everything that they do. They are not constrained to follow a single path. And they will change their approach to circumstances on the basis of changes in the mood of the people, changes in the conditions of foreign states, et cetera, et cetera. Their end goal, though, is always the same, and it's that which regulates their specific strategies and their specific tactics. And their end goal is essentially to consolidate their power in as central and immediate a way as possible so that they can essentially perpetuate their rule indefinitely. These are individuals, in my essay, returning to my essay, there's a section in which I talk about the kind of economic filter which is in place as well, and the sorts of people who emerge at the top of the economic order. These are individuals who, in general, not all of them, of course, but in general, tend to be less moralistic than the average human being. They tend to be less sympathetic or empathetic than the average human being. In many cases, these are individuals who probably do not have any kind of empathy in any real sense, or at least they're perfectly willing to throw it aside in the interests of their avarice and in the interests of their gain.
Are they lizard people?
Exactly.
It's a useful metaphor.
It is a useful metaphor. Yeah. And I mean, it's very apt. These are like cold-blooded and carnivorous creatures. I mean, in a certain sense, some of them might not even be human beings altogether, right? insofar as, you know, it's questionable to what extent a psychopath is a human being. But they have arrived in these positions thanks to their willingness to completely disregard all scruples and all moral considerations. And there's a way in which the more willing you are to do that, and at the same time, the more capable you are of, you know, making the most out of the situation surrounding you, the more liable you are to arrive. You're going to surpass individuals who might not do the same sorts of things that you are willing to do because of moral scruples or what have you. So the people who arrive at the very, very top echelons of this capitalistic order tend to be amoral at best, and they tend to be interested primarily in their, you know, in their gain, in their profit.
Yeah, and what does it profit a man if...
Exactly. But that's the sort of thing that they would never ask themselves, or at least they're so good at it, you know, denying their basic humanity that they're capable of closing themselves off to that kind of a consideration fundamentally. And that makes them extremely dangerous. I mean, these are the very individuals that in the past the social order was built in a certain sense to actually prohibit their entry into any kind of position of power or rule. And now we've established a state of affairs in which they are the ones who arrive. This is our meritocracy, our much famed meritocracy, unfortunately.
And it's very rigged if you look at it. That's the funny thing. If you just look at how the money system works, the banking system works, you know, the corporate structure is you have to follow a certain agenda. And I think to a certain extent, if one is a talented, hardworking, creative person, he can attain a certain level of success. But to get to that meta level, it's almost like, you know, it's like Robert Johnson at the crossroads. You have to sell your soul. And same thing with fame. And you can rise to a certain level, but for the most part, if you get to that, if you're hanging out at Bilderberg or Davos or running around the woods at Bohemian Grove, you know, and there is a certain, a point where you make that decision. And certain, celebrities have talked about that, how there's a deal that's made once you attain a certain level. And if you don't make that deal, you just simply, your career ends. Or you don't, it's sort of a Masonic thing, you know, where you can rise through the ranks, or you can be a porch brethren at the outer circles. But if you get raised, what it said is when you get to the higher degrees, you're given an opportunity to do things. If you don't do things, you simply don't advance anymore.
Exactly.
You know, and so there's a structure mechanism to it that's created to make sure that the right people advance, and, you know, decent people simply don't go that far. So you have this sort of this psychopathic structure that's enforced created and maintained.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the, you know, late stage democracy. This is what happens right before the system collapses or changes into something else completely, which is to say that these amoral individuals, these extraordinarily unscrupulous and Machiavellian individuals, have become so prolific within the system that they are actually able to form their own kinds of societies within the system, of kind of informal class, if you will, which, you know, nobody is capable of naming because it's not official in any sense whatsoever, but nonetheless is existent and has a great deal of influence. And once that kind of an secret society, in a very literal sense, has been established, they are able to do things like exactly morally bribing any, you know, kind of counter initiation of anyone who wants to join their ranks. And at that point, you've established conditions in which you are not only choosing for some of the worst individuals in our society, but you are actually making certain that no good individuals are capable of breaching that inner circle.
And you talk in the article how certain, and there's an argument to be made that this some people see this as a problem of scale, meaning the if you have the a political system which is properly decentralized, that a certain amount of accountability can be maintained. That in a larger centralized imperial system where you have the corruption at court, so to speak, you know. You know, the example would be the Roman Empire, where right. once it became an empire, the administrative requirements of the empire supplanted its republican order, and more power, had to be entrusted into the throne of Caesar, the emperor. And of course, obviously, one man can't control this thing. This is a system of corruption. This is why. How many times were emperors, murdered? obviously, if you're a godhead, that couldn't happen.
became a going habit there towards the
exactly.
End.
The Praetorians would decide who the emperor was.
Exactly. Right.
But because this is the court, the seat of Rome, the corruption, the same way of whether it's Brussels or London or Washington D.C. and these things, the seat of corruption. But again, there's inevitability. I go back to the American order, how it was originally designed, or at least set up. Was very decentralized.
Yes.
Washington itself, but that was more of a common market with a mutual defense pact, and then the powers were diffused to the United States that were very jealous of their powers. But inevitably, the forces of centralization took over, all in the name of progress, material and political.
Nice.
Whether it's Lincoln talking about Empire of Liberty, the railroads, these things, always talking about progress and liberty. But you had the destruction of sort of mediating institutions, the same way in the 20th century, under the American century, under the guise of integration and interstate highway system and mobility, you had the destruction of ethnic enclaves, regionalism. Now, this served the purposes of the empire because it created this kind of this bland, broad American white identity that's spoken of today. But in the process, what was destroyed was sort of ethnic consciousness in America, which was sort of counter to the imperial drive. Because a good example would be what happened to Catholics in America in the 20th century with their diaspora into suburbia. And then they could wage the culture war, the sexual revolution, the baby boom. These things were largely a Catholic function. But, with the agenda of sexual revolution, contraception, abortion, they've created sort of this deracinated mass today, which is now seems to be on the chopping block, or at least from the standpoint of identity. They want to bring in the immigration. People openly talk about the browning of America, but if you say, well, what about white America? They call you a racist.
right.
Well, then white does matter. Does it exist or doesn't exist? What is it? But then that's part of the trick is this part of the liberal agenda where they talk about progressivism, where if you want to maintain any ethnic identity, community, a cohesive community, these things, you're opposed to integration, to multiculturalism, to diversity, But there is no such thing as tolerance, because even this tolerance agenda, they have to enforce some form of conformity. Any society is going to have an idea of notions of deviance. It's a question of what's considered deviant. Someone's values will prevail. So this the same way that democracy and liberalism contradicts themselves and there really doesn't exist, tolerance doesn't really exist either. Because we all have prescriptions and prescriptions that we have to follow.
Yeah, exactly right. If you look at tolerance in very basic terms, again, I think it can be articulated precisely why tolerance is failing so radically in our day. Tolerance is essentially the proposition that we must be open to every other worldview. The one should not denounce or negatively judge any other worldview. That's the basic sense of tolerance as we promote it nowadays. Obviously not the original sense of tolerance, which is very different, but the way that we speak of tolerance as a virtue nowadays, that's what we mean. Now, any society, and particularly a society which is attempting to become multicultural, will inevitably come up against the fundamental problem that there are individuals who promote intolerant worldviews. We can think of any number of examples in our present societies. Perhaps the most salient being, here in Europe at least, Islam. You know, radical Islam is a fundamentally intolerant worldview. That's part of its nature. So what is tolerance to do when it comes up against intolerance? How is it going to confront this problem of intolerance? And it has only two options. On the one hand, it can embrace its own tolerance to such an extent that it absolutely refuses to pass any kind of moral judgment on any other viewpoint, no matter how intolerant or how harsh or how dangerous. And at that point, you know, it's essentially going to disappear. I mean, it will eventually be consumed by the intolerant position, which is basically more zealous and more powerful. Or else it can state essentially that it is going to be tolerant of every worldview which is tolerant. But this is basically an impasse for it, because most worldviews that have been promoted, ideologies or what have you, most ways of living and being amongst human communities at a certain point are intolerant. They have their standards of deviance and their standards of acceptability. It emerges that practically the only worldview which is capable of embracing tolerance as such is the liberal, tolerant worldview. So the very notion of tolerance, the notion that you are going to be tolerant of everyone who is not intolerant, reduces to the proposition that you are going to be tolerant of everyone who is a liberal like you. You are eliminating the basic preconditions for any kind of variety, diversity, or certainly multiculturalism. And so the consequence of that is that eventually you're going to have to start clamping down on, you know, speech which is intolerant. You're going to have to start opposing yourself to anyone who proposes something which, you know, goes too far outside of the liberal worldview. And the end result of this is the establishment of a perfect homogeneity, supposing such a thing can even be achieved. But that's definitely the kind of tendential aim of it.
And it even fails pragmatically. Yes. Its philosophical contradictions are clear, but even pragmatically it fails because, well, a good example is some of the legal cases here in the United States, where recently we had a case where it went all the way up to the Supreme Court, where a gay couple wanted to demand that a bakery make a cake for their wedding.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Okay, and so initially, the initial decisions, the local ruling, then the state ruling, were finding and dragging the small business into court, you know, as they appealed, demanding that they make a cake for these two men who wanted to pretend being married. And finally, the Supreme Court said, no, they don't, because basically it's had something to do with how the law was enforced. I forget the technicality. But basically went all the way to the Supreme Court, and it was determined that they don't have to make a cake for this couple. Now, I would have said, I could avoid all the legalism and say no, because they shouldn't have to. They should have the right of refusal. The pragmatic question would be, go find another bakery. Why would you want a baker who doesn't want to make a cake? You make your cake. But again, that's not the point, really. You know, the point is, again, it's this intolerance. In the name of tolerance, they essentially want to threaten this baker with jail time, ultimately, because if he doesn't comply with the law, he goes to jail. If he doesn't make a cake for him, how is that tolerant? And it doesn't fail right. Pragmatically, because you go through all this expense, because basically the reason is the culture war. Obviously, they want to shift. They're shifting the culture through litigation, through lawfare, as they call it. And they're making a point, obviously, when really just said, okay, fine, we'll go find, I'm sure you can find a baker willing to make a cake for not asking any questions, you know, but no, that's not the point. So really it becomes this morass of legal battle. And that's part of the objective, is just to create all this confusion and clacking and cranking and noise. So we all get involved in this ridiculous argument, you know? So that's that, you know, that's one of these things where you're like, wait, this is ridiculous. This is absolutely absurd. And of course, in the name of tolerance, we're supposed to accept the fact that transvestites are invited to go to public school and give a reading of fairy tale stories to children.
Right.
You know, teaching tolerance, the Southern Poverty Law Center, which has been in the news lately, has a program where they teach tolerance to grade school kids. It's all about promoting, you know, all types of degenerate behavior. And this should never be, regardless of that issue, I think we can all agree it's not appropriate to present this to children, who should just be learning the basic, you know, three R's at that level. But then this portrays the real mission of compulsory public schools. It's not there to educate.
Yeah,
it's the mind control. It's the program, and that's clear. And again, is this type of nonsense? Is this is this late stage democracy that we're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, in my opinion, it is late stage democracy. I mean, I tend to take a somewhat different view of this than many people. I think most people would say, for example, that the United States has been a democracy since its inception, and I don't think this is true. The founders did not believe they were establishing a democracy, and I tend to believe that they probably had a better and clearer grasp of the government that they themselves proposed and framed than any of us moderns do. They were building republics. Republics being a specifically modern form of government which attempts to, again, it attempts to establish mechanical controls on the abuses of power. And it's aimed fundamentally at low-lying human concerns such as material wealth and basic well-being in the sense that can be easily grasped and in many cases measured, such as standard of living, et cetera, et cetera. This form of government, which was the model for many, many European states as well, ultimately yields democracy. It results in democracy. But democracy is fundamentally different. I mean, democracy is essentially the belief that the people, the popular sovereignty, should be the basic decisional feature of government. And so, I mean, at this point, what we find ourselves is our republics have shifted into a democracy. This has happened in various historical points in various countries. In America, I think that it can be located, practically speaking, after the Civil War. The shift began, and it really got into its stride in the last century. But one of the fundamental principles of one of the fundamental characteristics of democracy is that they are not long-lived. They are, in general, very, very short-lived regimes. This has been the case throughout history in most parts of the world, with very few exceptions. And those exceptions generally are exceptions for articulable characteristics of the area in which they are formed. For example, in Iceland, where there's kind of an ethnic homogeneity and long-standing traditions which have promoted this kind of democratic regime. But most of the time, democracy collapses very quickly, or it transforms into something else. The ancient Greeks believed that democracy tended to transform into tyranny, and there are ways in which one can certainly see how that would happen. That once the social order becomes unraveled to a certain point, or factions begin to develop to a certain point, there will step forward a figurehead or some kind of leader who's capable demagogically of convincing the people to support him, and he will take power, he will take command. But oligarchy is certainly another possibility, and we're seeing the emergence of oligarchy as well from our democratic orders. So, I mean, the question essentially is, what's going to happen now? And this is one of the really interesting questions of our time. What exactly is this democratic order in which we find ourselves going to result in? Because democracy, contrary to our modern myth, is not a stable form of government. Quite the contrary. Democracy promotes vested interests on the one hand and interest groups on the other hand, and the conflict of those two things leads inevitably to social unrest and the decay of any kind of overarching social morals or ethics. And the result sooner or later is that society tears itself apart. Right now what we're seeing is that the different factions within society, the different groups, either ethnic groups or else religious groups or else political groups within society, begin to attempt to commandeer the law. They're no longer interested in the Constitution, certainly in the way that our grandparents were interested in the Constitution in the United States. Mm-hmm. They're no longer interested in the law of the land, more generally speaking, because they perceive that the law of the land is simply a function of the popular will. And so the question is, how can one form a majority in order to change the law of the land as one sees fit toward whatever ends one wants? And this is also true on the social scale. It's not just true politically, but there's also this sense that whatever most people believe goes, and so you've got to change public opinion in order to try to control dissident dissident groups from gaining any kind of upper hand. And the consequence of this is that sooner or later you're going to come up into this situation in which there are differing worldviews within a society which disagree fundamentally about the basic premises of society and the basic aims of society. They cannot be in any way related to one another. You cannot find a compromise between them because they exist in two completely different spheres, and they will wage a kind of war, whether it be the war of politics or the war of legalities, or perhaps even, God forbid, an open war in order to have their way.
Yeah. I'm thinking of Thomas Cole's series of paintings, The Course of Civilization.
Right.
Where, you know, goes for the, you know, state of, you know, of I guess the rural state, then the trade republic, then empire, and then collapse. But exactly. It's hard to obviously prognosticate and predict. We don't know the future. But the, I mean, if you think about, you know, the collapse of Rome itself, where it created a dialectic in Europe and then created Christendom, you know, so we don't know where this leads. We're not given that information. We can only kind of try to, you know, I guess, stand up for the truth and speak our minds and not be cowed. And that's, I think, the challenge that most people face today is, as we eke out our living so we can live day to day and support our families, we at the same time have to play a part of a true citizen and not be intimidated from speaking real truth to real power. Which
I agree. Yeah. Yeah, I agree entirely with that. I mean, I would also just say that at the same time, we also have to have a very clear clear sense of the fact that what we're dealing with here is a regime which presents itself in one way and is in fact in a very fundamentally different way, which is to say that we all believe we're existing and we're living in free societies in which one can speak one's mind, societies in which it's, you know, possible to say all manner of things and, you know, one will not face any kinds of ramifications from that. In point of fact, we're living within societies that have very specific interests, very specific goals, very specific ideas for what society is and what it should be. And they are, as any kind of government, any kind of regime, they are willing to fight against dissenters in, you know, any number of ways. And I think it's kind of difficult for us to perceive this because we have this idea still that, you know, particularly in the United States, for example, with the First Amendment, there's this sense that, you know, we still live in a free country. But this is one of the reasons, in my mind, it's so important to attempt to understand the real principles at work underneath the kind of appearances of the day, because we're not really living in that kind of government anymore. We're living in something different, and it's a kind of government which pays lip service to freedom of speech. It certainly pretends to be the friend of liberty, but it has absolutely no regard for these things, and in many cases, these things act directly contrary to its own vested interests, and it will look after its vested interests. So, I mean, to an extent, I think that we should also pay mind to that dynamic of our day and attempt to, you know, find ways as well of not only speaking truth, which I think is very important, but also doing so in as effective a way as possible.
Yeah, I mean, there's a tendency. I mean, I don't think the oppression will come, at least not in the immediate future, the knock on the door at 3 a.m. where you're dragged away as your neighbors look away.
You know? Also because that's ineffectual. It's not, you know, they prefer doing things in a non-legalistic fashion through these kinds of, you know, enormous tech companies or through middlemen or third parties, right? There are other and more effective ways for them to silence people.
Yeah, they'll shut down payment systems. These are supposedly neutral services are being offered. It's like saying, you know, if you're if you have a certain political belief, you try to get you go to the dry cleaner to get your shirts clean. We're not going to do this because your political beliefs. And right. As society becomes more corporatized and centralized, that's more of a possibility. And we have, like, the example is China's social credit system, which the West seems to be adopting in one degree or another, where if you're a dissident, you are gradually alienated or ostracized from the functions of normal society to the point where you can't even earn a living anymore.
Yep.
And that is a way of simply suppressing or intimidating dissent or alternative views to these things. I mean, again, this is supposed to be a society that is liberal and free. It also betrays the collusion that's going on. Where are the antitrust laws when you need them? You know, right? I mean, it's like whether it's Amazon or Google with YouTube or...
Where's Teddy Roosevelt?
Yeah, the trust buster. I mean, so there obviously there's collusion. So people who think you're a conspiracy theorist, wait a second. I mean, how is it someone gets deplatformed and then gets their financial services cut off? The bank's not going to do work with you because you have a certain position on immigration? I mean, that's ridiculous. But that's what's happening. Yep. And it is that's the gamification of life. And this is again a function of technology again, as we like the conveniences that it offers, but it also deprives us of the bulwarks or defenses against being intimidated because of its efficiency. A good example would be a lot less efficient not to have your doors locked at night because you could leave, come and go without having a door. But we put a lock on the door because it's inefficient. It prevents the animals and thugs from getting in your house. The same way we should take approach towards technology. But again, there's what we should do. There should be an awareness. There should be a shaming of these corporations that do this. And attempt to boycott them or these things. But I think we're at a stage now where there's such with these corporations. There's an interlocking directorate, and when Gillette runs an ad that's insulting towards men. They know it's going to have the effect, get people talking. They don't care. We can laugh at it, and it's easy to make fun of it. But at the end of the day, they don't care if you don't buy Gillette.
No, exactly.
Because Gillette's probably owned by the same company that owns the competition, that owns the media. So they all meet at Davos and strategize. So it's not really – you're dealing with a corporatist globalist monster that's imposing, the homogenous state, which is what you speak of in the article. And that's what we're really fighting against. And that's, again, it's one of these things where at the first point, let's disabuse ourselves of the illusion that we're living in a free society at first. So we have consciousness.
Yep.
Once you have consciousness, and then you can start from there, and hopefully it will follow a more peaceful path. But that's the biggest thing, at least part of your article, is just, the main point of your article is this, okay, let's dispense with this notion of democracy and freedom. We're not living in a democratic free society. It's a facade, okay? Come on. Let's be honest about this,
Yeah, exactly. And it's a facade that might have had some reason to exist, say, 50 years ago, but now it's becoming just simply dangerous to everyone involved, to the citizenry. It's dangerous even to an extent, I think, to the elite that are running it insofar as really we are moving steadily toward a situation in which it's probably going to be impossible for society to continue in any kind of legitimate sense. But I mean, I think that your point there is spot on in my mind. We have to disabuse ourselves of the illusions regarding our situation, and that includes, to my mind, this kind of very... this faith that we all very easily adopt that we will have recourse to the law in the case of injustices, particularly as regards, our ability to speak our minds.
That's your congressman.
Yeah, exactly. Write your congressman or, just refer to the First Amendment enough times and things will magically work out. We're not living in that kind of a world any longer. And again, as you said, it's not a question of, the secret police busting in your door and taking you away and putting you in locking you in a prison cell somewhere. But there are ways in which, anyone who speaks out against the system too stridently and too obnoxiously above all, will be neutralized through the various means that they have at their disposal. These people will be essentially ostracized from any kind of social interactions. They'll have their means of purchasing taken away from them, et cetera, et cetera. They won't be able to find any kind of media through which they can speak. All of these different ways that the present system has of distancing these people from their ability to speak freely and openly. And so, I think that the next step after disabusing ourselves of the illusions regarding our situation is also to attempt to formulate other approaches to our situation, which is to say that it might not be enough any longer to simply, you know, outwardly, to go out as kind of a champion of truth and to, you know, explicate all of the various injustices which are happening, because the ways that they have found of neutralizing precisely that kind of approach are growing ever more ubiquitous.
Yeah, I mean, if you think we're being paranoid, I mean, well, look around you. Just follow the news.
Right.
You know, get your head out of the sand. But also, I mean, this a good example in East Germany, and this was talked about at the end of the Cold War. The East German government was considered one of the more repressive regimes in the Warsaw Pact, but they had the Stasi, the infamous Stasi, had a policy called dissent. A strategy called disintegration, where there was they didn't go after suspected dissidents or opponents of the state by putting them in the gulag, locking them up. They slowly dissolved their life by making sure they were alienated from their friends, didn't get the jobs, drove them into depression, and quite often the victim would do the work of the Stasi themselves by committing suicide. So there's a psychological angle to this. So they understood how they could do this. And there was a network of informants, a vast network of informants that would do the same way that YouTube has trusted flaggers programs. It's the same thing, same philosophy. Well, whether or not this is being instituted in the West in some degree or another, well, I believe it was the Department of Homeland Security, when it was being set up, was advised by, I think it was Marcus Wolf, who was a former Stasi official.
Interesting.
You know, and also that today's the Homeland Security has these local, what do they call them? Fusion centers.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Fusion centers. Well, the design for that is based on elements of the Phoenix program that was utilized in Vietnam to wage war against the Vietnamese population, to undermine the what they called the infrastructure, you know, of the Viet Cong, which means the civilian population. So these tactics have been practiced for decades, and they change, and they're weaponized differently as they apply to different societies. So the network is there. Let's not forget there's always the off chance that they can, if they really don't like you and you're influential enough, your car can blow up.
Right.
It's been done. I'm sorry.
Right.
There's always that.
Yes, exactly.
You know? So that's the reality is we're living in this society. We've tolerated and accepted various institutions like cryptocracy, these secret agencies and these things in the name of national security and these things. Let's disabuse ourselves of the notion that there's openness and there's oversight and we're free, and then move on from there. And this was, which is an important part of your articles. The articles is let's accept reality first and move on from there. That the problems are that we're facing, the contradictions that we have in our society, and move on, and then perhaps we can, from the wreckage, establish some sort of at least a more virtuous political order that's on a more human scale and these things. So,
yeah. If I might just say one last thing, I mean, I think that we have to be playing to two different and, to my mind, integrally related areas, which is to say, on the one hand, the personal. I think that we should all be attempting simply to live more virtuous lives in our own very small spheres, because there, even if that can't have any kind of grand influence on society as a whole, it's already establishing something which is lacking in society, and it's establishing an example which is lacking in society. I think that the effects of this are really quite beside the point, even though they might be underestimated as well. But there's something to be said simply for the virtuous life as such. And so, you know, living in a virtuous way, despite the absolute disorder and vice of the time in which we live, is already an enormous achievement. Beyond that, I think that we should be playing for the long game, which is to say that we're, rather than attempting to, you know, get out and agitate and, you know, bring up some kind of mass movement, which is going to get the right guy elected, who's going to change the system, et cetera, et cetera. All of which is, to my mind, if not a fairy tale, at least highly unlikely. It's again, the same liberal mirage. It's the same illusion that we've been living under. Rather than doing that, we have to begin working toward altering the fundaments of this entire order that we find ourselves living in, which is to say that the principles upon which it's founded, we have to work toward understanding it in a deep, in a very deep way, quite beyond the appearances. Obviously, you know, paying attention as well to the daily events surrounding us, but attempting to understand the roots of all of this, because it's only from the roots that we're going to be able to change anything in the more distant future.
Yeah, and obviously getting our own lives in order is a prerequisite for establishing a more sustainable social order, because
yes,
society is just an extension of individuals. And individuals, if they live properly, they can coalesce and build communities. And you know, if you're living a dissolute or immoral life and then preaching how to save the world, you know, you end up like Rousseau, where you proclaim a love, profess a love for humanity, but hate people, you know. And so, yeah, getting your own life in order and these things. And that is a prerequisite of these things. Is if you talk about whether it's the problem in your church, in your community, but your life yourself is a wreck, well, then start with yourself, right? And then move on from there. Because you'll be in a position, and not, as an example, but also you'll have the moral capital and the real capital to make people's lives better, taking care of your children and these things, and then they become responsible citizens and these things. It's not
right,
easy,
right. Raising a new generation of individuals who recognize duty over right.
Yeah, so that's key. So these articles, of course, you can find them at Arctos Journal, right?
That's right, at Arctos Journal, which is accessible via the website for Arctos, arctos.com. We also have a podcast called Interregnum, mm-hmm. in which we discuss many of the same issues to which you dedicate your show, Tim. and so, yeah, that's right.
Okay, well, I highly recommend the podcast. I've listened to several of the episodes. It's very edifying, and it's very dignified, and it's a great listen. I recommend that. Also, the articles. Also, I've purchased a few of the books there, so I recommend people go to the library and support some of the books. Very provocative books there, so I highly recommend it. I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Tim, it's been my great pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I might also mention that we will have a title coming up in the next few months, certainly this year, which I think might be of interest to your listeners, Catholic and Identitarian by Julian Longella, which is presently in the process of being translated. So we do have a number of titles which might be interesting to your listeners.
Well, that's,
so
that's
I do recommend
thank
that everyone.
You. Yeah, I'll look out for that. Thank you. I'll let you go. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon. And
you, Tim.
When I post this, I'll send you the link.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I look forward to it.
Have a good day and enjoy it. Bye-bye.
And you. Goodbye.
There's a man going around taking names, and he decides who to free and who to blame. Everybody will be treated all the same. There'll be a golden ladder reaching down when the man comes around. The hairs on your arm will stand up with the terror in each sip and in each sup. Will you partake of that last offered cup or disappear into the potter's ground? Hear the trumpets, hear the pipers, 100 million angels singing. Multitudes are marching to the big kettle drum. Voices calling, voices cry. Some are born and some die. It's Alpha and Omega's kingdom come. And the whirlwind is in the thorn tree. The virgins are all trimming their wicks. The whirlwind is in the thorn tree. It's hard for thee to kick against the pricks. Till Armageddon, no shalom, no shalom. Then the father hen will call his chickens home. The wise men will bow down before the throne. And at his feet they'll cast their golden crowns. When the man comes around. Whoever is unjust, let him be unjust still. Whoever is righteous, let him be righteous still. Whoever is filthy, let him be filthy still. Listen to the words long written down when the man comes around. Hear the trumpets, hear the pipers, 100 million angels singing. Multitudes are marching to the big kettle drum. Voices calling, voices crying. Some are born and some are dying. It's Alpha and Omega's kingdom come. And the whirlwind is in the thorn tree. The virgins are all trimming their wicks. The whirlwind is in the thorn tree. It's hard for thee to kick against the pricks. In measured hundredweight and penny pounds,